Greetings, film freaks. We are the Popcorn Kernels. Join us as we discuss the hard and often indigestible truths that are at the center of the fluffy and delicious world of cinema.
What's poppin', people? Welcome to the Popcorn Kernels podcast. My name is Adam, and joining me in the ear holes is Harry. Say hello, Harry.
What's your father, dear? Is he a coal miner? Does he stink of the lamb? You know how quickly the boys found you, all those tedious, sticky fumblings in the back seats of cars, while all you could do was dream of getting out, getting anywhere, getting all the way to the
Walmart for our 2-for-1 on grenades.
On today's episode, we will be talking about The Straight Story. This is a 1999 film directed by David Lynch and stars Richard Farnsworth, Sissy Spacek, and Harry Dean Stanton. IMDb describes the synopsis as follows. An old man makes a long journey by lawnmower to mend his relationship with an ill brother. Here is an original song to support the synopsis.
Please don't die on me, bro. I just want you to know. As I age, I'm getting slower. Hold on, I'll come on my mower. I am Alvin, and you are the Lyle. Forget the past, let's go in style.
Red says stop.
Stop, stop, stop.
Green says go.
Go, go, go. Let's start with some facts about the film. The movie is based on a true story. The real Alvin Strait lived 1920 until 1996, living 3 further years after he took the journey. Did you know this was based on a true story?
I did. The front cover of the DVD says as such.
Oh, okay. I had no idea. I think it's an incredible true story.
Mm.
One that speaks of determination, hard work, fighting adversity to travel. Do you know how many miles it was?
250?
250 miles on a lawnmower.
And obviously, given his age, he couldn't do, say, 12 hours a day like, say, I would.
Yeah.
If I was in New Zealand, I'd drive 12 hours.
Yeah.
But for him, he probably could only average 4 or 5 a day.
It's such an amazing story to think that someone that are in the latter stages of their life travelled so far for the sake of seeing their sick brother.
Yeah.
So
it's almost like life imitates art, isn't it?
Yeah.
And you wouldn't think it's a true story.
No.
But it's very much like Odysseus and the Odyssey and that journey home. Because home to him is reconciliation with his brother.
Yeah. I don't know that story, the Odysseus.
Long-ass trip.
Okay, not for this podcast episode.
No.
Okay. Richard Farnsworth was terminally ill with bone cancer during the shooting of the film.
No.
Yeah. He actually took the role out of admiration for Alvin Strait and astonished his co-workers with his tenacity during production.
Jesus.
Because of the pain of his disease, Farnsworth committed suicide the following year at the age of 80.
I didn't know he committed suicide.
That is fucking bleak, isn't it? To portray someone who, within the film, is very, very ill.
My God.
But it now makes sense when you watch that performance. You see, it's all in his eyes for me. The way he's misty-eyed, he's welling up.
Reflecting.
Like, he can directly correlate the story to his own circumstances and situation. And reading that after watching the film, it really adds some substance
to
it.
No idea.
Yeah, the poor fucker. I mean, the film is a beautiful film. It's uplifting, it's heartfelt and stuff, but him in a central performance, after knowing this fact, it feels like it's enhanced because of what he was dealing with in his real life.
I'd watch it again now because you said that. That's amazing. I never knew that.
Imagine acting a really painful scenario that you're going through and living alongside that story that you're
foreshadowing.
Well, yeah, that must have been so difficult for him. And it's not necessarily the most physical of performances. He spends most of the film sat down on a lawnmower.
Heavy dialogue.
But having that going on internally and acting a very similar story must have been taxing, must have taken its toll on him.
That's the pedigree of method acting.
Yeah. Well, I guess
eat your heart out, Daniel Day.
I guess that's not even really method acting because he's actually living the character he's playing. I think it's a really interesting fact. It's so sad that he felt to take his own life. But if he was terminally ill and the pain was too much, he lives the film and his real life in a similar vein must have been hard to do one after the other. Yeah. Bit of a downer, really, isn't it?
I didn't even know that. I didn't read too much on it. I watched the film and then was preparing. I had no idea he killed himself.
I think that if you know that fact before watching the film, it certainly beefs it up. And yeah, like you said, I'd probably watch it again knowing that fact because it's a heavy one. Yeah. When asked why he decided to direct a movie like this, which would seem very different from the rest of his projects, David Lynch said that when he read the screenplay for the first time, he felt such a strong emotion that he decided to be the one responsible to try and bring that emotion onto the screen. Now, I'm not necessarily a huge fan of David Lynch. I know he's got quite a big cult following. I know he's highly regarded, but me personally, I haven't seen many of his films. In fact, I only think I've seen one, which is Mulholland Drive. But he's a director whose reputation precedes him. Like, he's known for being an oddball director, doing really strange...
They change every time, though, don't they?
Yeah, high concept, really unusual films with hidden meanings and different points of views and all of that. Like, he, even without knowing his body of work, I know he's that sort of wacky oddball, so to speak, sort of director. So to see him being interested in a film like this, which is quite a straight story, it's... Yeah, I applaud him for that because I like it when directors try something different.
It turned a lot of critics' previous opinions on him the other way. So Roger Ebert never rated him ever. And then he gave this film 4 out of 4 stars. And I think it's a very hypnotic film in a sense that it's slow. It's like an ASMR of films. Yeah. It's relaxing almost. It's a very sit back and observe it. I think throughout the whole film, Alvin's reflecting on his life. And you're sort of seeing that, like you were saying, he's all of his acting's with his emotions. He can't be physical because of his age. But yeah, very different from what Lynch has done. I mean, I've only seen Twin Peaks and Blue Velvet. Twin Peaks being the series. And I was probably too young for Blue Velvet.
Yeah.
I wasn't gripped by it, but it was odd. I can say that. And I have seen the trailer to Eraserhead. And that is some fecked up film. The special effects are amazing.
Yeah.
But in terms of watching it, I felt like I'd have to be very happy and let my happiness drop to watch it. If you're a little down, I wouldn't touch Eraserhead. It looks depressing as shit.
Yeah, I feel like David Lynch is probably a director that I would appreciate. I like my strange films. I like my out there concepts. But for one reason or another, I've never got round to watching the films that are synonymous with his name. Mm. And as I mentioned, I know he's got a huge following and that people love his work. After watching this, I certainly want to see how it contrasts and compares to those films that are considered a bit more zany, a bit more out there. But were the films that you've seen from him, are they completely different compared to this one?
Yeah, I mean, Eraserhead's nothing like Mulholland Drive. Mulholland Drive's nothing like Blue Velvet. This is my personal opinion.
Yeah.
And this film's nothing like anything he's ever done.
Mm.
There's nothing weird or esoteric about it. It's a straight story, like you were just saying.
Yeah.
Not even intentionally trying to say that.
Yeah.
It is a very straight story.
Yeah, it does exactly what it says on the tin, doesn't it? Yeah. I would definitely be interested to see his other work, just to see how out there it is in comparison to this one.
You know, he does acting as well.
Does he?
Yeah, he appears in John Carroll Lynch's film, Lucky, which stars Harry Dean Stanton.
Is he a good actor?
Eccentric. But I just thought it was funny because the director, John Carroll Lynch, shares the same name as David Lynch, no relation.
No relation.
Stars in a film with Harry Dean Stanton. David Lynch is in it.
Yeah, it's all connected.
It is.
Tell me your favourite things about the film.
One of the first things that became apparent is that I share a lot of similar traits with Alvin. One, his love of rain and lightning storms.
Mm.
I love rain and lightning storms. And the fact that in a film they show someone who likes them rather than like, oh, look at this weather. And the other one is the adverse reaction he has to cyclists.
Okay.
So within minutes, yeah. I was like, oh, God, I get on so well with this dude. I loved that aspect. So the little things that show up in the film give you an insight into him as a person.
I think if you relate with a character in a film, I think that gives you a head start straight away. Because if you can hold the experiences that you're seeing on screen and realize that you would act in a similar way or you enjoy the same things or anything like that, I think it goes a long way in an overall enjoyment of a film.
Like if it rains, he gets giddy and excited.
Yeah.
And he'll go and sit on his porch and he'll light one of his cigars, or there's a moment in early on in the film, he pulls into this old barn and lights a cigarette and just watches the rain. And I love that. I've got a lot of time for that.
Yeah, I find...
hypnotic, therapeutic.
I find calm in the storm as well. I enjoy, as long as I'm not stuck in it, I enjoy watching that. And I think that you mentioned that sort of atmosphere that that builds when you're watching his character enjoying that storm. I think that runs throughout the film. Like the music, the background, the backdrops, the scenery, all of that just makes for a very sort of oddly soothing film when you consider the subject matter.
Yeah.
What else did you like about the film?
Like just what you were saying, the music. Music's beautiful, very emotive. Angelo Badalamenti, he's collaborated with David Lynch on numerous films, but the one that come to mind also where I enjoyed the music, the series Twin Peaks.
Yeah.
Boom, 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 boom. Very simple, but really effective. Mm. And I found the score in that film was lovely. I've listened to the soundtrack quite continuously for the last 24 hours.
Yeah.
That the lone fiddle over the guitar, it's very pretty.
Yeah.
Very well scored film.
It's noticeable, isn't it? Mm. Sometimes I watch a film and most, if not all films, has music going on behind it.
Mm-hmm.
As someone who isn't necessarily honed into music or doesn't know a great deal about music, there's probably the majority of the films I watch, I don't pick up on it. But I certainly picked up on that, and it was a beautifully scored film.
The film probably gave you time to enjoy it.
It's true.
Because it's slow, and it's, like you said, there's loads of long shots, lots of landscape, lots of destination shooting, and it just gives you time to take it all in.
Yeah.
It's done very effectively. I love the music. Love it.
Yeah. Any other favourite elements of the film?
The end scene when Alvin's character finally makes it to his brother's abode in the middle of the woods. I honestly believe Harry Dean Stanton does more acting in 60 seconds than some actors can do in a lifetime. Just the way he sees this little mower, and he obviously puts two and two together and realises his brother has taken one hell of a long 7-week journey to get to him, struggled. It's like a pilgrimage. Like, yeah. To be a pilgrim is to suffer.
Yeah.
But it's also the journey. It's the journey, not the destination as well, which I think's lovely. But Harry Dean Stanton's only got... he's got minimal screen time in this film. Yeah. Right at the end, he's got 60 seconds, maybe more. And it's his reaction. He even managed to produce two tears. And there's not many words exchanged or traded off. And it's almost like, as an audience, you understand the effect it has. Look, he's clocked that journey his brother's just taken to see him. It sort of washed the slate clean of all the prior shit.
That recognition speaks 1,000 words, right? Mm. They didn't have to have a massive conversation of dialogue. They didn't have to put their demons to rest, because within the film, it's understood that the siblings have had some sort of argument and they haven't spoken for 10 years. Alvin Strait finds out that his brother Lyle has had a stroke and he wants to make amends. So he embarks on this really long distance journey on his lawnmower to see his brother.
Because he hasn't got a driving license.
Exactly, yeah. His health is withering, his eyesight shot to shit, and he wants that moment of redemption. And like you say, it's my immediate reaction was, wow, Harry Dean Stanton's hardly in this. Like, he needs to be in this more. What, I looked at the runtime and I was like, how is this nearly finishing? Mm. How is he not in it more? But the beauty in the film lies in the fact that he doesn't need to be in it.
Mm-hmm.
Like you mentioned, nothing needs to be said. They didn't have to have this really emotional conversation. They didn't have to air out their dirty laundry. It was just understood. And sometimes the simplicity of that speaks much, much louder than having a really big, weighty, emotional scene.
Yeah.
Have you got any other...
I had bullet points. It is the ASMR of films. It's hypnotic. It's a pilgrimage of reconciliation.
Nice.
The journey of 1,000 miles starts with one step.
Oh, beautiful.
Old Chinese proverb. And just look, I've walked a pilgrimage, and there's something about how time slows down and you realise when you get to the end that it was the journey. I think he needs the journey to think a lot about what he needs to change about himself to make this work with his brother. It's a very, very sweet film. Very sweet. Yeah.
I see. I can tell you've obviously connected with the film a lot, and the fact that you've done essentially a pilgrimage a couple of times and you can relate it to a character, I think it would be impossible for you not to find some enjoyment in that. Having a shared experience always helps within film. If you feel like you know what the protagonist is going through, then yeah, it certainly helps.
Road movies are very effective in that way, aren't they?
Yeah.
Take you on that journey, you follow them.
Yeah. My favourite thing about it was Richard Farnsworth as Alvin Strait. Knowing what I do know now about his personal situation and how it relates to the film itself, that just enhances my opinion of his performance. It's a powerfully emotional performance that relies on the actor's ability to emote with his eyes, like I mentioned earlier. Mm-hmm. In a film where I found the dialogue to be quite limited, Farnsworth turns in this really raw and heartfelt turn as a stubborn and tortured senior citizen. And it's not, he has some fantastic one-liners with great wisdom, and, you know, he has great gems of dialogue. He doesn't necessarily speak a lot, but when he does, he says things that demand to be heard. And the fact that he can just portray this role, it's all in, considering he's so physically limited, it's such an oddly physical performance. Mm. Like the use of the walking sticks.
Double canes.
Yeah, he needed them. They weren't a prop. They weren't a prop to support the character. He needed them to move around.
Whoa.
So when he's getting off of the lawnmower and back on again, when he's crouching down to pick stuff up, that's not necessarily acting. But to use those real life experiences just enhanced it all, and I thought it was fantastic. I mean, the film was really uplifting, but it's something profoundly devastating about seeing an old man and then knowing he's really fucking struggling as well. It just, yeah.
What? Still can't believe he killed himself. That makes me want to watch it again now, because having that knowledge now makes me, I'd probably watch it even more stringently.
It's almost, I don't want to sound too morbid, but it's almost like a suicide letter, isn't it?
Yeah.
A performance that is so close to home.
As strange as that, Larry's similar, because Harry Dean Stanton did Larry in 6 months after he died.
Whoa.
At 90-something plus years old. And it's all, and that film is all about facing mortality and signing off. It's insane. What you were saying about some of his one-liners, I love the one where he says that someone asks him, what's the worst thing about getting old? He said, the worst thing about getting old is remembering when you were young.
Yeah.
And that's so valid. I'm only 30-something.
Yeah.
And I'm like already like,
ooh. Yeah, exactly.
Mortality.
I share those sentiments exactly. I was watching it and I know I've still got, well, fingers crossed, I've still got a lot of life to live. But even I remember younger days where I didn't have to make a noise when I get up, when I didn't get a sore neck because I slept incorrectly or ridiculous things like that.
Make a noise and you go,
that's what's happening. So I can imagine that's only magnified when you've had so many more decades behind your belt. I love the fact that the piece was a really profound film about life not being about the end of the journey, but about the people we meet, the experiences we counter along the way. It's a deeply thought-provoking and moving film that's handled superbly well in terms of direction, as we've mentioned, the lead acting performance. I think combined with the imagery and the music, the sentiment and how heartfelt it all is, it just makes it a really nice film that makes you look introspectively. Mm. And not all films have to be big explosions and action and violence and loads of clever, quirky dialogue. Sometimes it is just nice to watch a simple journey, a simple story. I love that.
I think you've hit it on the head.
Yeah.
Definitely.
My final favourite thing about it is kind of a similar point, but it's just how uplifting it was. Despite the story being framed by death, the film highlights humanity's ability to look out for others, even during times of personal struggle. So
the girl at the campfire.
Yeah. So Richard Farnsworth as Alvin Strait is obviously going through a hell of a lot, but he puts that to one side to go and see his brother. And he meets various people along his journey that he helps with just his wisdom, just being there, just being a presence. And I think that we've all found ourselves in dark situations, and even in the darkest of times, to be able to help others, I think that speaks to a very big strength in our species, basically.
Warms the soul.
It does. And the whole film, despite being effectively about death, mm-hmm. how it hits us all, it asks the audience to appreciate what you experience while you've still got it. What were your elements of the film that you didn't like?
The twins. There's a couple of mechanics in the film that are twins that go to fix. They have to fix Alvin's motor after he almost killed himself coming down a hill in it. I don't know. Their sort of dialogue and on-screen presence was quite hokey.
Yeah.
And I just thought it wasn't needed. But then again, I think because it's a Lynch, the way Lynch does characters in a film, like this is why I felt it was very like an odyssey, this film, because he comes across so many eccentric and oddballs. Comes across a young pregnant girl. He's got her head screwed on, but she's a bit, you know, prickly. He comes across this nutty woman who's killed 9 deers.
Yeah.
And she just has this crazy little monologue, gets in the car and drives off. So when you come across these two twins and they're bickering about pricing and stuff and they both have red hats on. I just thought they were a bit hokey.
I think you're right, though. And this is from someone who doesn't necessarily know Lynch's work but knows enough about him to have a general idea of what he's about. I think he has to have them little bits in sprinkled around the place because it wouldn't, I guess it wouldn't be a Lynch film without those oddities involved. I'll come on to a point that I didn't like about it when it's my turn, but I have similar opinions.
I think any time that the film stopped, like that it stopped the music and him trotting along and showing me this beautiful landscape, I was almost like, no,
yeah,
keep going.
Yeah.
I want to watch you for an hour and a half. Just keep going.
Yeah. Focus on the old boy on his lawnmower. Yeah. I'm not interested in anything else.
No.
But I think in essence, that's a great thing because that's all we should be caring about.
Hmm.
We shouldn't necessarily be caring about a woman that's hysterical because she's run over a knife deer or whatever it was. We shouldn't care about two really oddball twins that didn't necessarily fit the film.
He eats that deer, doesn't he?
He does, yeah.
It cuts to him cooking it.
Well, you would, wouldn't you?
What a meal. Yeah, man. After living on them bratwursty sausages that he's got in that little cool box, and then he gets this lovely bit of venison that was died, not of natural causes, but it was hit by a car. He utilised it, and then he puts the horns on his trailer, didn't he? Oh, that's quite cool.
Yeah. I think you look at that and you can really see that he's a experienced man who has lived a life. And throughout the film, he said, "I've seen a lot of things." You get a little,
it's a sniper,
a little, you get a little footnote about he's passed in the army during the Second World War. And I think that scene just shows you how well adventured he is. You know, like he, even as an old man, he was able to skin a deer and gut it and kill it and enjoy it.
Yeah, he says, doesn't he? He was a sniper in World War II because where he grew up, he had to learn to hunt for food and stuff.
Yeah.
That guy that acts opposite him during their little war, they share their war stories together. What a performance.
He was great.
The way he was shaking and building his arms, like, is that real? Now I know, look, someone topped himself after the film. It's like, well, did they both serve in the war?
Yeah, did that guy know he was in a film?
Was he actually just telling a true story?
Yeah, and then the cameras just went, all right, we'll leave you to it now, and he's there broken in the bar.
It was good, man.
Oh, God. What else didn't you like about the film?
It took an hour and 34 minutes for him to have a beer.
That's too long.
Come on.
Yeah.
He's doing the journey. He's smoking like a trooper, big fat cigars. He's taking all of that in and obviously he passes up alcohol. You get the impression he's had to go sober because of the toxicity that it obviously produces in families and friendships.
Well, he mentions in the film, didn't he, that when he got back from the war, like
he found
comfort in liquor, and he's been clean for however many years.
Mm-hmm.
And interestingly, he found himself having to have a beer on the last chapter of his journey before he saw his brother, which he was obviously...
You can relate to that, can't you?
What's that?
A confidence beer, a Dutch courage beer.
Oh, God, yeah. Yeah, pretty much any social situation I find myself. I've gone to job interviews before where I've had a couple of beers before because I was so nervous. Not afraid to admit it.
No. Overshare.
Yeah, I was only 19, but I did have 3 bottles of Budweiser and I smashed a team interview.
Did you get the job?
Yeah.
What's a team interview?
Well, when there's a team of people interviewing.
Oh, I thought you had a team.
Oh, fuck no. I'd needed 12 beers if I was holding a team meeting. Oh, well, I had a group of people backing me up. Yeah. These are my boys. They're coming in with me for the interview.
Hello, Miss Lady.
Yeah, from Step Brothers. Yeah, no, I understand the necessity of Dutch courage and having a beer beforehand. And if I was to go on a journey like that, I know he wasn't exerting much physical energy. Granted, he didn't have much physical energy to give. If I was going through that landscape and seeing those sights, hearing those sounds, smelling
so inspiring.
Those smells, I would have to finish the day with a beer.
Mm.
So I that's a fair point. I would have definitely stopped probably every evening. And
I would love to do that journey with you on a little wooden moped.
Should we get a lawnmower each?
Little lawnmower. Just go 280 miles, just taking everything in, chatting, little walkie talks. I always find road movies inspiring.
That would be a great podcast as well.
Oh,
just on a lawnmower, just as we're going along, just talking about our experiences. I'd listen to that.
Yeah.
That'd be great.
Yeah.
What else didn't you like about the film?
It was quite close to home for me. Experienced such similar circumstances to Alvin in terms of families and stuff. So it's very easy, obviously, to fall out with family members. But obviously, if you come from quite a stubborn family, it's much harder to reconcile them differences. And there's a great bit in the film where he says... I'm not doing it justice, but he mentions about how ego mixed with stubbornness and mixed with alcohol just caused them to fall out. And it's quite close to home. So it made me sort of reflect on, say, relationships. Like, I find too stressful to have in my current life. But yeah. I've got a good 35 years until I feel like I need to reconcile them.
Yeah,
so when I do, I'm going to go and buy a Dear John or a John Deere mower, and I'm going to do that.
Yeah, I think you should.
3 hours.
Yeah.
Maybe.
I'll come with you. I think that's interesting because you were able to identify similarities to the character that I see as positives, self-reflection, enjoying a storm, being out in the open, broadening your horizons, all of these great things, which I think are an asset to you and your personality. But the fact that parts of the film make you look inwards and think about other situations within your life that you're not as happy about, I think that's a good balance. And I think from hearing you speak about it, it's certainly made quite a big impact.
You should be a counsellor.
Well, if this doesn't work out, who knows?
No, not really.
They're quite solid.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, obviously it's not a modern film, so it's not as well polished as some films can be. But I think for what the intention was behind it was captured really well. You get what I mean?
Yeah. I'm certainly a film lover who sometimes struggles with watching a film that's decades old and looking at some of the acting or the special effects. But in a film like this, there's no need for special effects, and some of the acting wasn't great, but the chief guy in control, was outstanding. So any of those problems, I say I could look past, but the main thing I didn't like about the film was the supporting cast. Not all of them, but minor characters within the film lacked any real acting talent. That sometimes caused the distraction, especially when sharing a scene with the constantly impressive lead man. Like, you got a neighbour that she just sat there eating donuts and she wasn't...
I knew you'd dislike her.
Well, she wasn't... I don't know, I've got to tread carefully here, but...
She's quite synonymous with this film in terms of if you see an image of it. She's quite prolific in the imaging of this film,
yeah.
Which I thought was weird because she's obviously got a... I'm not being rude, but if you're a right old fatty mess...
I'm not being rude, but if you're a fatty mess...
Why do you care if you're tanned or not?
Yeah.
Sitting down, tanning herself.
Yeah.
And then going to get a snack and you hear someone fall over in the adjacent house. And it's Richard Farnsworth, isn't it? But yeah, it was kind of an odd, eccentric character to have that didn't actually play a pivotal part in the film.
I think that was something that ran throughout the film. The actors that didn't really have a lot to do, I found them distracting. Like the lady you speak of, I certainly, because any scene she was in, she was just stuffing her face.
It's quite reminiscent of What's Eating Gilbert Grape. Now
the,
I think
the mother
of it.
In that.
No, not just because the mum's fat. No, I mean the characters look. You come across in a film, if you watch What's Eating Gilbert Grape, the supporting characters or the ones who are just passing through, it's really similar in that sense. Maybe it's the setting, though, the empty fields and the sort of run-down sort of economy. I don't know.
I think maybe if you want to look deeper, I mean, they're all single-serving characters in terms of this film, but you've got an old boy who's through age and maybe smoking and drinking and other struggles he's dealing with is losing his life. And then you look next door, there's a woman who is basically wasting hers by not being physical, by overeating and doing all of this. So maybe there's something to be said within that, like right on your doorstep. He's doing all he can, not necessarily to prolong his life, but to make the most of what time he has left.
He's driven.
Right next door, yes. Right next door is someone who is wasting theirs effectively. And there was the shop owner, a few of the, like the twins, like you said, a few of the actors, they didn't have a lot to do, but when they're sharing a scene with Richard Farnsworth, I did find him a little bit grating.
Mm-hmm.
And talking of grating, I might sound controversial for saying this, but I did not like Sissy Spacek in this film. Yeah, we all know she's a talented actor. However, I found her casting as the daughter of Alvin Strait to be a really poor fit. The character of Rose was written as someone who has learning difficulties.
Is it true that his daughter had learning difficulties?
I'm not sure, but SpaceX's performance felt like a stereotyped characterization rather than a credible performance with any redeeming qualities. And for me... For me, a huge talent like Sissy Spacek... In a film like this where she doesn't necessarily have a lot to say or do. But if you have someone with that talent in there, like one, you could argue use her more. But the bigger argument, I think, is she could have done better with that performance. It felt like almost a piss take of someone with learning difficulties.
That might be to do with the times, though. So
could be.
Moving forward now, obviously, it's getting more and more frowned upon for someone who's not disabled in any way, shape or form to play someone that's disabled. It's getting more and more kickback, isn't it?
Yeah, and in some instances, rightfully so. In a film like this, I think if you'd had an unknown entity at that point, having the chance to play someone with learning difficulties, if it was a good performance, you could question if they were someone who had learning difficulties. I think of Dead Man's Shoes, where Toby Kebbell plays the brother of Paddy Considine's character, who's got severe learning difficulties. And he was a relatively unknown in before that role, and he was fantastic in that. Mm-hmm. But he really gave a believability, and you really empathise with him as a character.
It wasn't overacted.
No, SpaceX turn, it felt like it was almost a piss take. It felt like a 80s or 90s sketch show when people were allowed to take the piss out of those of us who were...
Scope.
Yeah, struggling with learning difficulties and stuff.
Mental, physical.
Yeah, but yeah. For me...
I think the director of My Left Foot's sort of not disowned My Left Foot, but he said, looking back, he probably shouldn't have made it. Which is tragic for me, because I think it was one of the best performances I'd ever seen from an actor.
I personally don't have a problem with an actor acting, whether that they're acting as a different sexuality from their own, a different level of capability than their own, they are acting. Where would it stop? You would have someone, there would be no Marvel films because there's no Thor, no God of London. Yeah, where would you stop?
It is a weird subject, because I find it strange when they say, like, Eddie Redmayne apologises for, what's the film where he's...
The Danish girl.
He's transitioning. But he's transitioning from a man to a woman in the film.
Yeah.
So
that is acting.
So why do you need to go and hire someone that is in the process of transitioning for that role? And it would be like saying, right, so Sheldon's character in Big Bang Theory, he's straight in the film, in the series, right? But in real life, he's homosexual.
Yeah.
So then you flip that coin, it'd be like, well, Sheldon should now not play straight characters. Yeah. There'd be uproar. And you can't do it like this.
I don't know.
Barring blackface, I totally, like, that is of clearly wrong.
Yes.
Downey Jr. in Tropic Thunder, they're doing it intentionally.
It's a parody,
It's a parody on blackface and how ridiculous method actors can be. Yeah. Nauseating to some degree. But this whole straight playing a gay playing straight, disabilities being played out, you know, I don't see anything wrong with it.
I think representation is important. And I think this is a topic we could quite easily do a whole episode on. But I think it would be too limiting to only have people play the roles that they fit in. That's the talent of the craft of acting, is to be able to portray someone that you're not, right? Mm. Whether that's a disability or whatever it is, that's what acting is.
That's tight casting. So Hugh Grant's first, you know, three or four big pictures were Hugh Grant.
Yeah.
You know, playing this very posh-spoken London romance icon. And, you know, only in his latter life has he started to break away and take on some more meaty characters, good or bad.
Yeah.
Pierce Brosnan should stay typecasted, though. Shit, that guy. apart from the film he did with Jackie Chan, oh God, what was it called, where he's essentially playing the head of Sinn Féin political party.
The Foreigner. Netflix.
He does great at that, but then he is an Irish-American, so he's mailed that. But Christ, his accent in Fire Saga. Jeez, playing an Icelandic guy. I want to just shoot myself.
There lies two other podcast episodes, one about whether it's okay for actors to... act in roles that they can't directly associate with, and how shit Pierce Brosnan is. That's two. That's two lengthy podcasts, I feel.
You're right, though. How far could you take it? Would you imagine The Wire without Dominic West or Idris Elba? Imagine Band of Brothers without Damian Lewis.
Mm.
You know, you could go. Imagine Peter Dinklage not being in Game of Thrones because he's an American, which means there was no medieval European America. Like, you can go so far with stuff like that.
Exactly that.
Yeah,
exactly. And it is a minefield, isn't it? Striking what's right and wrong with that sort of thing.
By left, I will become right.
Pretty much, yeah. Mm-hmm. My last element of the film that didn't necessarily work for me was the unbalanced dialogue. I mentioned it earlier. Richard Farnsworth had some amazing, insightful and impactful dialogue that really helped his standout performance. But many of the other characters, they didn't have the same level of material to work with.
Mm-hmm.
I understand the film's focus is on, you know, one man's journey. But when the journey in question meets so many people along the way, I think the film would have benefited from those encounters being better written. Other than one character that he meets within the film that's very gracious, the character Alvin, his lawnmower starts to buckle and he goes speeding down the hill, almost crashes. Mm-hmm. And the kindness of strangers, this guy welcomes in into his home, but he doesn't want to stay in the friendly guy's house. He wants to sleep outside. He wants to be independent, all of this. I think that was an interesting character within the film. Mm-hmm. The rest of the other characters, they weren't particularly good, weren't particularly memorable, other than the final meeting of the straight brothers. I feel all of the other supporting cast.
I liked the pregnant stranger girl he comes across on the road.
Yeah.
Only because he has this nice moment of around the campfire where he says, you know, when I used to get my kids to all take a stick each and tell them to break that stick and they could all do it.
That
and then
nice.
He'd say, I'd tie them all together and try and break it. And you can't break it because that's family. And when he wakes up in the morning, this young pregnant girl who's run away from home, she's left him a little bouquet of sticks tied together.
But
it means I got your message. I'm going to take your message.
If you use that analogy within the film and you put all the sticks of the little side characters together, you would be able to break them because most of them were so shit and damn.
Waterlogged.
Yeah. So
you could bend them to thine will.
Exactly. And I just feel when the film does so well in every other aspect, the atmosphere, the feeling, the plight of the protagonist's journey, feel all of this really going for it, the music, the aesthetics, all of it. I know we mentioned it earlier, Lynch and his oddities and his quirkiness, they had to be in the film. But for me, it did lessen it a little bit, if I'm being honest.
Yeah.
I have three questions I would like to ask you.
Please go ahead, my good sir.
David Lynch is a highly regarded director with a huge cult following. Did watching The Straight Story make you want to watch more of his work?
No.
Okay.
No, I'm very joking. I would I'd give Mulholland Drive a go, definitely.
Oh, that's the one I've seen.
Yeah, I haven't seen Mulholland Drive.
I liked it.
I saw Blue Velvet years ago. I'm talking years ago, 15 years ago, easily. Rented it from college library.
Nice.
VHS. I would love to watch Eraserhead, purely for the special effects maybe, but it just looks so bloody depressing. Like raising like this really grossly deformed baby.
Is that what it's about?
From what I can guess from the trailer.
Okay.
But it's set in this like really dystopian, apocalyptic sort of world. Visually looks impressive, but apparently like disturbing, very disturbing. Part of me feels like this is probably his tour de force, probably.
Which is interesting considering how wacky the rest of his back catalogue is.
I mean, maybe I trust in, say, the Roger Ebert and maybe some good critics. I've read their reviews.
He deserves his reputation, right?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, I think it was such a change for him. It's like if you were to say to me, like, what would you like to see Tarantino do? Now, imagine Tarantino did a really beautiful, heartfelt love story with no blood or violence. It would be shockingly different from everything he's ever done.
A Tarantino rom-com.
Yeah, but imagine if it was.
I'd watch it.
You know, or a Tarantino sci-fi or a Tarantino
The man
horror.
Could shit on a plate and I'd still watch it for 3 hours.
No, that's what I'm saying. I'd be so excited to see a change.
Well, I'd like to see more of his work after this one. And only seeing Mulholland Drive, which I remember enjoying. I remember for 2/3 of that film, it's quite, for lack of a better word, a normal film. Then it gets a bit weird in the third act and it dreamlike and trippy and stuff. And I did enjoy that. Comparing it to this film, I would never have guessed they were the same director. If I was shown these two films against each other, I would have no idea it's the same guy directing it. And because of seeing two of his films, I would like to see more of his well-known stuff.
Mm-hmm.
Richard Farnsworth and Harry Dean Stanton were both excellent in this one. Would you like to see more films that focus on the more senior members of society?
Yeah, definitely.
Yeah.
It's a lovely change of scenery.
I think so.
Beautiful. I mean, straight after this film, I went and watched Lucky.
Yeah.
With Harry Dean Stanton.
Recommend it?
Oh, highly.
Yeah.
Highly. It's great. Hour and 29 minutes.
Yeah.
Directed by John Carroll Lynch. And it's of a similar vein, really, but of a much more cantankerous, rude character.
Mm.
Just watching that last minute of The Straight Story just made me want to go and put a bit of effort into Harry Dean Stanton, because I've always loved his character actors. His characters, like in The Green Mile.
Yeah.
You know, I want Mae West to sit on my lap and I'm one horny motherfucker.
Yeah.
And in Alien, his back and forth with Yaphet Kotto in that opening 20 minutes. Some of the most naturalistic acting I've ever seen. So, and I think he's revered as one of the greatest character actors of all time.
I think cinema is a little guilty of painting more senior actors with a brush of either they're starting to go a little bit senile. Mm-hmm. Or they're this warm grandparent figure.
Mm-hmm.
And I think there's such a wide scope where you can explore older experience without necessarily buffing it up for it to be more sentimental or making it feel really sort of bringing its audience down with the hefty subject matter. I think there is a area between the two that I'd like to see explored more.
Yeah, something not gimmicky like grumpy old men.
Yes.
Even though it's funny.
Yes. And
but it's a piss take of being old.
Yeah. And the recent film with Anthony Hopkins in the lead role, The Father.
Mm.
Beautiful film, expertly performed by...
Make you cry?
By, oh, floods and floods of tears.
Ooh, I need to watch.
And that was brilliant. And Sir Anthony Hopkins is getting on a bit now. But even that film, it was looking at the end of the life and what happened with the complications of dementia and how it impacts the person going through it, the family, the people looking after it. But I think there's a space where we can have nicer stories without it feeling too sentimental. My final question, would you be interested in seeing a Coen brother remake of The Straight Story starring Tommy Lee Jones and Jeff Bridges as the Straight brothers?
Who's on the mower? Who's Alvin?
Ooh. Tommy Lee Jones. So yeah. Grumpy. But then Jeff Bridges has got such charisma.
Yeah.
The reason
yeah,
I
watch
ask,
it. I mean, yeah, I'd watch it. I don't think it's needed.
The reason I ask is they are making it.
Oh.
No, I'm lying. I am totally
oh, really?
Lying. Yeah, they're not. I just
now
came
I don't
up with it.
Now I don't know what to believe. Is that a horse?
I think outside. I hope not indoors. What would you rate The Straight Story out of 10?
7.5.
Ooh, I thought you might have gone a bit higher.
I love the music. Like you, love Farnsworth. Harry Dean Stanton had a tiny role in it, but he's honestly, get the opportunity to just watch that film, wait for that minute and a half of Harry Dean Stanton's acting. Very, very good. Yeah, 7.5, I think.
I did go with 7.5, but then when we started speaking about it and how it made me feel, how warm, how it made me look within myself.
I thought you were going to trash it.
No, not at all. It's a lovely film. It's, as I say, it's really depressing. But it's the outcome is really heartfelt and moving, and it's the music, the scenery.
I felt inspired.
Yeah, I'd rate it an 8.
Oh,
thinking
man. That's
so
awesome.
That gives The Straight Story a total score of 15.5 out of 20, which
oh,
is
mega.
Decent. Yes,
I'm really surprised you went with it. 8.
Yeah, definitely a recommendation. Listen, I thought it was brilliant. It was similar to some of my favourite films. Like Forrest Gump, it has all of the emotion.
Gump's a road movie,
yeah,
I think.
Yeah, Into the Wild as well. That's another one of
Little
my
Miss
favorite.
Sunshine.
Yeah, they're all these road movies that make you feel happy and sad and reflective and angry. All of the emotions, and I'm here for films that make you feel a spectrum of feelings. 15.5 out of 20. Yeah, go and check it out. Consider watching this one if you enjoyed The Way, Forrest Gump, and Little Miss Sunshine. Should we play a game?
Yes.
The game in question is What the Plot, where the rules are simple and the results quite the opposite. Harry will conceive an original idea from his big and beautiful brain and give birth to a plot. It is then down to me to nurture this thought by providing a film title, genre, cast, and anything else I can think of to raise this brainchild into a fully functioning film concept. Over to you, Harry. Star Wars.
TriStar. Fucking Star Wars.
It sounded like Star Wars to me.
Ah, bruv.
Sorry.
Okay. The outside world has lost contact with a Caribbean island. All they know is that a radical female dictator has taken over the island and cut off all communications with the outside world. Consider it maybe like your Cuba in the 60s. The CIA want to get someone on that island, get some eyes on that island, get some ears on that island, right? They stop a plane in Florida that's on its way to this Caribbean island, and all they find on there are the best looking male prostitutes you have ever seen. Abs, no hair, apart from good hairline, everything else has been plucked. They pull one guy off the plane, they let the plane go because they don't want this island dictator woman who's called Maria Morshock to find out that they're onto her. So anyway, it's routine. They pull the guy off the plane like, sorry, you can't go, your passport's out, so no one suspects anything. They grill him. They're like, you're going to prison for a long time. You need to tell us what the deal is on this island. Anyway, this Maria Morshock, she rules with an iron fist, right? But her one weakness is man, bear, pig, men. Really hot, six-pack dudes with no hair on their bodies, male prostitutes. She's getting them in by the dozens because she has this weird thing that she can only sleep with one guy once and then he has to leave the island. So what they do, the CIA, take one of their rookie cops, shave him. He's already got a six pack and they train him to be a male prostitute and he's going to go on the next flight out to this island. Kind of like a Wicker Man. He's got to infiltrate the island. He's got to report back what's going on this island. But what actually happens is he gets nabbed by her one night and he has to have sex with her, sleeps with her. But he's the first person she doesn't make go back to the mainland. she starts to fall in love with him and he starts to feel stuff for her, even though she's this little dictator who's taken over this Caribbean island and has this really weird fetish for shaved, muscular men. Kind of like a Donnie Brasco of a Caribbean island with Maria Moreshock, the great dictator of a small Caribbean island. What are you going to give me for that, Dada?
I haven't decided yet, but that it's almost like a really odd rom-com.
That's cool. I'm down. I'm going to listen now.
Kind of. So, in summary, the outside world loses contact with an island where there's a female dictator called Maria
Moreshock.
Maria Moreshock. Planes flying over.
No. So they stop a plane that's on its way to this Caribbean island in Florida.
Okay.
And it's just full of male prostitutes.
Right. So they find out that the Maria Moreshock is thirsty and she's been getting planes of male prostitutes over.
Yeah.
So the FBI use that as an in to get in an undercover agent and to see what's
CIA.
Happening. Right.
Because okay. It's not on foreign soil.
Maria Moreshock, she sleeps with these chiseled Greek godlike prostitutes.
So only vice.
And then she bangs them and
back on the plane.
Yeah, bangs them and fucks them off.
Yeah.
Yep. She's just using them. She's just using them for a fucking throw.
Yeah.
That's what she's doing.
Yeah.
So she the FBI clock this, send a CIA undercover agent.
Stop saying FBI, CIA.
CIA, I apologize.
Yeah.
CIA agent undercover to sleep with this woman to try and find intel.
Yeah.
Then they end up falling in love, basically.
Yeah.
And she then the peril is her finding out that this sexy male prostitute.
CIA sexy male prostitute.
Is actually a CIA agent, but he falls in love with her.
Yeah.
So that's, for me, that's a straight up rom-com that's framed with a really like odd kind of dictatorship subplot.
Well, I feel like she's considered a dictatorship from the outside, like they would have thought Fidel Castro was. But Fidel Castro wasn't torturing people or anything. He was just trying to build an independent Cuba, let's say.
So is this island full of women? Does she only let women?
There's men there, but she only wants the best of men. So she imports the male prostitutes.
Are the males that are living there just sort of ruffian types? They're not the good-looking prostitutes that she
subjects.
Ships over you. So she's not
interested. She's gone through any of the good-looking ones on that island.
And do the residents, just for a little sub-context, do the residents of this island, are they supportive of Maria Moreshock or are they against her? Is it a dictatorship that they're very much against or is it as the propaganda, are they sort of brainwashed into
I think it's a dictatorship to a point where it's very egalitarian, communist, to the point where she's like, we're all working together for the state. So they're doing the fields and stuff. They get medical care, they get food and stuff, but they live in essence like an egalitarian sort of communist society.
Okay.
And that's why, similar to say like your Cubans and stuff. So she's not necessarily hanging people or shooting them, but she's just cut all ties with the outside world. She is dictator in a sense.
Yeah.
But if it's a rom-com, there can't be a little taste of genocide on the left or right.
No, okay.
And I didn't actually say it in my initial hypothesis. It's synopsis. So, like, you're right. It can easily be a rom-com. And it's just more look, why can't we deal with this island? Why can't we talk to this island anymore? And it's almost like that, isn't it? America doesn't want them to be independent from trade because they control the whole trade.
Okay. So I would first and foremost still see it as a rom-com with some elements of drama in there. I would have Taika Waititi directing because he's good at, he's sort of almost slapstick.
I'd agree with
comedy.
This.
I can imagine
Hunt for the Wilder People.
Yeah. I can imagine him really, excelling in like a rom-com that's not normally not your generic rom-com in terms of setting. And I think in the lead role of this female dictator, Maria Moreshock, would be Blake Lively. Now, she is a very, very attractive woman.
Mm-hmm.
And I could see her being in this really powerful role. And I'd have the undercover CIA agent as her husband in real life, Ryan Reynolds. They would have that chemistry and to see them acting alongside of each other, whether it's the whole like, oh, will they, won't they shouldn't fall in love. They do fall in love. Then there'll be the conflict between them all when it can take a turn. They can have the conflict between the two parties. I think it'd be quite fun for all involved. It'd be quite lighthearted, quite fun. Lively and Ryan Reynolds, because they're a real couple. Taika Waititi at the helm. And I would call the film Lust in Paradise.
This summer, find love in a hopeless place.
Wait,
You're telling me that I get to go on a tropical island, make love to a beautiful woman, and I get paid for it?
That's right.
I'm your man. I put the dick in Dictator.
Ryan Reynolds is Ryan Reynolds. And Blake Lively is Maria Moorshark.
This isn't paradise. This is my island. Disobey my rules, and you'll be sleeping with the fishes.
From the director Taika Waititi comes the most anticipated rom-com of the year.
Wait, how many male prostitutes have you slept with?
263.
I thought I was special.
No, baby, you're just 264.
Lust in Paradise, rated R.